Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Daryl Geist. He's Habitat Coordinator for Buffalo Field Campaign, a position he's worked in for 12 years. His experience with the Yellowstone Buffalo dates back to the early 1990s when he worked with Cold Mountain, Cold Rivers, and videographer Mike Meese to publicize the state of Montana's slaughter of these majestic wild animals. After graduating from college, he migrated to Montana, a habitat he dearly loves, from his home state of South Dakota. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me on.
So, if you don't mind giving, we've had Stephanie C. on here a couple times, and she's given a brief history of Buffalo, but if you don't mind, before we talk about what's going on now, could you give a brief history of Buffalo, say 4 or 5 minutes, and then bring us up to date with some of the things that are happening right now?
Certainly. And one of the things that make the Yellowstone Buffalo unique and distinct is they've continuously occupied that ecosystem for the last 10 to 12,000 years. The only surviving wild population in the lower 48 states. They are genetically intact, and in fact, some scientists discovered there's potentially genetically distinct subpopulations within the population. Yellowstone is the only place in the world where this ancient relationship between grizzly bears and buffalo continues to evolve. In contrast, most of the bison that people see today are in commercial domesticated herds. They're no longer wildlife. They're no longer to be counted as wildlife. And there's this public perception that we saved American bison from extinction. And in fact, the bison that were saved are essentially products of commercial production today. And there's somewhere near about 500,000 bison in commercial production. They're private property, they're livestock, and they're domesticated. And within public, tribal, private herds, there's this legacy of cattle DNA, a product of ranchers crossbreeding the two species about a century ago. And so most of the bison you see today are hybrids, offspring that are in domesticated livestock production. So that's just a little background that, these bison in Yellowstone are unique. They're distinct. They essentially represent the last wild population, in the United States, and they're under threat. It's been ongoing for a couple decades, but state of Montana does not tolerate bison migrating into the state. And there's this framework in place, it's called the Interagency Bison Management Plan, that guides management decisions about the buffalo and Yellowstone. But essentially, this plan was put in place by livestock interests, and it's benefited, it's to benefit the cattle industry by restricting the range, the natural migrations of these wild buffalo. They're captured inside Yellowstone National Park, and shipped to slaughter. And several thousand buffalo have been captured inside Yellowstone National Park for shipment to slaughter just in the last 15 years or so. Adjacent to Yellowstone National Park, and people should, in their mind's eye, think of this, surrounding Yellowstone National Park, in each direction are national forest lands. There's tens of millions of acres of national forest land surrounding Yellowstone National Park. And the buffalo migrate in every direction, east, they cross the pass over the Absaroka Mountains into Wyoming, where under Wyoming law they're managed in low numbers for removal. The bison migrate naturally south over the Targhee Pass, which is on the Continental Divide, into Idaho on the Caribou Targhee National Forest, where they are eradicated under Idaho law. And the bison migrate west and north into Montana, where they're subject to state law, which is defined in the Montana Code 81-2-120 as a species that's managed by the Livestock Department. And within that statute, the Livestock Department is giving wide latitude to remove these bison from the landscape, from Montana altogether. So this plan that's in place is essentially driven by state law, which puts the Montana Department of Livestock in charge of America's last wild buffalo. And this is a threat to the bison in Yellowstone.
So people who don't live in the West, or people who don't live in Montana, for people who don't live in that, in Montana, can you talk a little bit more about Yellowstone? Why would the buffalo migrate?
Yellowstone's a high plateau, you know, 6,000, 8,000 feet. And the winters are quite harsh in Yellowstone. You'll get 3 feet, 4 feet of snow in one event. We'll have temperatures drop to minus 20, 30, 40 degrees below zero. And winter range is found in these lower elevation habitats, and for bison along the river corridors. The Yellowstone River Corridor connects the bison to their winter range. The Madison River Corridor connects bison to their winter range. And so they're just following their natural migrations to winter range, which is really a key habitat for their survival. And most of the winter range is on Cusco Yellowstone National Forest. And these are essential habitats for the bison, and they are removed as they make their way to their winter range. And used to, for example, Gardner Basin, which is in the northern range of Yellowstone National Park, following the Yellowstone River into Paradise Valley, all the way up to Livingston, Montana. That was the natural winter range of bison in historic times. And as it stands today, they're all wiped out. They cannot go beyond Gardner Basin. They're shot or removed. So these significant proportions of their original range are off limits and determined by the state of Montana in these tolerance zones.
So can
so
you
give... significant...
Go ahead, please.
Just reemphasizing my point, there's these significant ranges that the bison originally roamed are no longer available under this management plan and state of Montana law.
And Stephanie has also talked about this, but can you give a refresher on the rationale used by the State Department of Livestock for promoting these slaughters? And then after that, we'll move on to the ESA stuff.
Yeah. Well, modern bison management is built on a house of lies. And the base, the foundational one, is that we've saved the bison from extinction, which is not true. And the framing of the house of lies is constructed around defining bison as a disease threat to cattle, to carry brucellosis. But this is, if disease is a concern to the state of Montana, elk, who also harbor the disease, freely range the state. And they've been implicated in potentially passing this disease brucellosis on to cattle, elk have. And so if it's a concern, why is there no equivalent plan for elk, wild elk in Montana? And there's 160,000 wild elk in Montana. So just keep that in mind. It's, you know, framing bison as a disease concern. It's been very effective in propagandizing people. And it's eliminated what we should be talking about bison, that they're a keystone grassland species. They provide for more plant and animal diversity in the landscape. You know, they maintain these grasslands. They provide food for grizzly bears and wolves. There's a lot of ecological benefits bison provide in the landscape where they're allowed to roam. And that should be what we should be talking about. You know, this lost ecological role of bison in the ecosystem. They're the grassland species. They are it. They help maintain these grasslands. And there's a lot of species that depend on those grasslands for survival. So it's been eclipsed. This house of lies has eclipsed, you know, the public discussion about the keystone ecological roles that bison fulfill in the ecosystem.
So can you talk just a little bit more about that? I think a lot of people are probably aware of what happened to Yellowstone when wolves returned, such that, you know, it helped trout habitat by causing the elk to not always eat the trees near the riparian zones. So can you talk more? You've mentioned it, but can you talk more specifically? So we know grizzly bears eat, and here's another thing I'm thinking about, is that salmon, they've done studies to show who eats salmon, and it's like, I'm making the number, it was like 70 or 120 species. I mean, there's the bears, there's eagles, and then you've got all sorts of insects. So whom do buffalo feed, and how do they improve habitat?
Their behavior, the whole rubbing, horning, wallowing, it's very distinct. And for example, in Yellowstone, if you have a chance to visit, and you should, you can see where on the edge of the grassland and the forest interface, you can see the bison have rubbed and horned and stopped the forest from encroaching on these grasslands. And those trees are dying. You can see them dying. They're debarked. But bison are fulfilling this very important role of preventing the forest from encroaching on the grasslands. And just the nature of their biological being, you know, they're very, for a 2,000-pound animal, they're very light on the landscape, and as they move along, they're, you know, consuming grasses, they're consuming sedges, and they're redepositing these seeds, right? And along with the nutrients to help maintain these grasslands. Birds and squirrels have discovered the bison fur, and there's several layers of it. Make an excellent nest. And yes, there's wolf predation, particularly in the winter months when a wolf pack could potentially drive buffalo into a deep snow and potentially be able to take one. For grizzly bears, you know, emerging from hibernation, that dead buffalo that died during the winter is a key food source for grizzly bears. And coming out of hibernation for bears and finding a dead bison in the landscape is a key find. And that's just some of the ecological aspect, but it's really their behavior, the wallowing. And the scientists look at this whole, you know, they wallow, they roll in dust, and they create these little patches, these little wallows that fill up in the springtime with water, and it's creating these little micro wetland habitats that are used by frogs, for example, to get to other habitat. That same wallow, as the summer comes on, it dries up, serves as a fire break. If there's a grassland fire, all these wallows on the landscape act as kind of a fire break. So there's fulfilling all of these roles in the ecosystem, and you know, fire and bison get together really well. They're, these fire-burn habitats, or bison preferentially seek them out, and they're helping restore those grasslands, and they're fulfilling a lot of functions. And, you know, grizzly bear today, right, eats livestock. The grizzly bear is dead. Grizzly bear eats bison. The grizzly bear lives. You know, so there's some contrast and comparison to what happens, you know, to other animals in the ecosystem that come into conflict with livestock. It usually results in dead bears, dead wolves. And bison, you know, if you're limiting the bison's abundance and distribution on the landscape, you're precipitating more conflict, you know, between these native predators and livestock. So they're fulfilling a very vital role in the ecosystem and is not talked about at all.
What would be an average lifespan for a buffalo? Would it be 10 years, 5 years, 8 years, 20 years? And I'm just going to do some math here, so it's just really rough. Just make it up. You know, whatever is, it doesn't have to be precise.
No, it's, in the wild, in the wild,
yes.
Bison can live to be over 20 years old, and these older aged buffalo are really vital to herd structure, family groups. You know, for example, the matriarchs, the oldest female in the herd, very important to the rest of the animals that are within her group. You know, teaching them how to be buffalo, showing them where they go at different times of year to get forage or get water. They're very important, and as these older aged buffalo are eliminated, right, you have a much younger class of animals. And so you, when you go after these older aged buffalo, you're losing that herd knowledge the matriarch has, right? You know, and you're disrupting this very close bonded and relationships within the herds. So they're very important. These older age animals are very important to the herd. Yeah, and water management, they don't care. It's like they just want a population target, right? 3,000, good enough. They don't care about age structure, right? They don't care if entire matriarchal groups are wiped out in a government capture for slaughter operation. But that's what happens. This is a detriment. It's a serious concern.
I think that's a really important point. And I was just thinking a moment ago when I asked how long they live. So if we just, for a quick and dirty estimate, say that they live 10 years average, when there were 60 million bison, that means that there were 6 million dead bison, buffalo, on the plains every year, which is a lot of food for grizzly bears and wolves and everybody down to beetles. That's a lot of body mass that has been removed from the landscape.
Yeah. Okay, food for all kinds of scavengers, grizzly bears, wolves, eagles, coyotes, foxes, magpies, ravens. Every species in the ecosystem is taking advantage of that dead buffalo in the landscape. Now we can live another day with that kind of food on the ground.
So let's talk about the Endangered Species Act and and what is your current work having to do with the buffalo and the ESA?
It's a long story.
Good.
But, I mean, here's the basics. 2014 Buffalo Field Campaign Western Watersheds Project petitioned to list Yellowstone bison as a distinct population segment under the Endangered Species Act. And it took the Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, over, it's like 13 months to finally respond to our 90-day petition, and they dismissed it. And we took them to court. We filed in Washington, D.C., and we got a ruling recently from U.S. District Court Judge Christopher R. Cooper, remanding the service's decision, essentially finding that we had presented sufficient evidence in our petition, you know, that bison might be warranted for listing. And the service now has two things they can do. One, they can appeal the decision to the D.C. Circuit. Two, they can begin their rulemaking process and arrive at a new 90-day finding based on Judge Cooper's opinion and order. And it's significant because, here's a little geek knowledge for listeners, the 90-day petition is an evidentiary standard, you know, sufficient evidence presented that this species may be warranted for listing. If you get through the 90-day process, there's a 12-month species status review. And this evidentiary standard is a sufficient evidence is presented that it is, in fact, warranted for listing under the Act. And what Judge Cooper found was that the service had applied this higher evidentiary standard to our 90-day petition and essentially, you know, regurgitated what the management says, that the management plan is just hunky-dory and it's going to conserve the wild species. And you know, 3,000 buffaloes just is plenty, right? But Judge Cooper essentially agreed with us and the evidence we presented in our petition that this number of 3,000 is far too low. And management doesn't recognize the best available science, which found genetic subpopulation distinction within the Yellowstone herd, that there's two genetically distinct subpopulations, one in the northern range, one in the central interior. And recently, just to add a point to this, the central interior herd there's been this precipitous decline. Back in 2005, there were around 3,500 buffalo in the central interior herd. And last summer's census by the Park Service arrived at a figure of 847. And of course, that's not counting the buffalo that have been killed, captured for slaughter, hunted this season. So the logical outcome these numbers is that the central interior herd number is far below the 847 that were counted last summer. So there's, for the central interior herd, there's been this precipitous decline. Management doesn't want to look at their own management, and so they tell the public, we don't know what's causing this decline.
Well, what do you think is causing the decline?
Management.
I mean, is that I thought you said that the decline was beyond the slaughter. Is it the slaughter that is causing the decline, or is the slaughter plus other factors?
It's management. It's the current management plan that's driving these numbers, driving the decline. I think the buffalo now have her knowledge of what awaits them in Garnet Basin, right? A trap at Yellowstone National Park where they're captured for slaughter. And we've seen the buffalo change their behavior when they're being hunted. And they know where they are not hunted, and they'll flee. They will leave these areas when they feel under stress. They'll just vacate habitat and search out some refuge where they will not be hunted or harmed or harassed. So the obvious answer to the decline is management. And I think there's this her knowledge that is starting to form where they know. They know what awaits them. Intelligent beings, and they're responding to these stressors and threats that face them when they migrate. And they're avoiding these areas as much as they possibly can. But it's winter time, and they need to get to winter range. And it's there, you know, down in the Garden of Basin. It's there in the Hepburn Basin. It's beyond those basins. So the herd is responding, management.
So what are you hoping for from the ESA position? What would be petition? What would be a reasonably positive response, reasonably positive outcome, and what would be an ecstatically good outcome?
Well, the Judge Cooper's decision was an ecstatically good outcome. The fact is, there's just no regulatory mechanism in place to protect these bison. We've tried in previous lawsuits to get protection and habitat for the bison, failed, court system failed. So to get this decision from Judge Cooper that's directing the Fish and Wildlife Service to make another 90-day finding, it's very significant. Based on what he said there, in his opinion, Judge Cooper, this Fish and Wildlife Service is going to have a very difficult time coming up with the same 90-day finding, you know, not warranted, right, that we sued them for. It's very likely. It's not certain, but it's very likely that the service does not appeal the decision to the BC Circuit. They're going to have to make a new rulemaking finding. And I think that's going to get us to the next step, which is this 12-month species status review. And so let's just know, this process, if it opens up, it's open to the public. And we can submit whatever best available science we have in support of listing bison in Yellowstone. It's subject to peer review. There's criticism of this. Are they truly independent peer review scientists? But in this case, it might be a good thing, because the biologists that are working for Yellowstone National Park, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, they're servicing the official line, right? Which is the current plan, current framework is just hunky boy. So to get independent peer review of the best available science and all these threats and stressors that the bison are continually under, it's probably going to be a good thing. But so we're poised to get to that next step in the listing process. And this is a listing of species under the Endangered Species Act is a 15-round heavyweight fight. We won round one, and we expect more rounds. We expect to have to go out and fight again. We harbor no illusions about that. And we're going to be prepared to move to this next round, which we hope to get to, this 12-month species status review. You know, there's any one of five factors under the Act. You know, list of species, you know, loss of habitat, overutilization, disease predation, inadequacy of regulatory mechanisms, or any other natural or human-made factor that affect their survival in the wild. And we think there is a lot of evidence that all five factors are operating on bison, as a threat to their existence as wild in the ecosystem. So we're poised and ready. We're going to need your support and those of your listeners to get to that next stage. And, there's a lot of ways you can get involved. You can volunteer your time, come to the Buffalo Field Campaign. We're equipped and ready to handle volunteers, and you can go to our website, buffalofieldcampaign.org, look up the volunteer information. We have a volunteer coordinator in place to handle the intake, train you, get you equipped, get your field ready. And you can make a donation, contributing money to the cause. You sure could use it. Pay attention. We're going to get to this next round in the Endangered Species Act listing process.
So how would this... I'm sorry if I'm being dense here, but how... If you win... You won round one, and let's say you win rounds 2 through 15. So what will be the process by which that will... What will that mean to the buffalo in terms of not getting shot? How does that... I'm sorry if this is just a really stupid question, but how will this help to change the, quote, management program, end quote, for better? What extra rules does that give you? Right. What extra levers does that give you to stop the slaughter?
Well, I think that the biggest point of getting this kind of ESA protection for bison in Yellowstone is it's going to shift away from this management plan, and we'll finally have to apply the best available science to protect them. And if a species is listed, all these federal agencies have an obligation to utilize their resources to recover the species. So, for example, as the bison migrate beyond Yellowstone National Park or the Custer Elton or the Shoshone National Forest or the Caribou Targhee, they're going to be protected under the Act. And the best available science is going to have to be the first concern. And it's this current framework, right, the laws of Wyoming, Montana, Idaho that eradicate, remove bison diversity. It's kind of a check, or potentially a checkmate. And this science-driven recovery process is going to be in place. And habitat that they're no longer accessing, right, under the current plan is going to be available to them. The bison needed for long-term recovery is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This habitat and the national forest, key to their survival, bottom line.
So if, go ahead, Sean.
It's not a magic bullet. It's just, it puts the best available science in the driver and not the whims or the regulatory mechanisms of the states.
So if you and the bison and we all were to win this 15-round fight, would it be realistic to think that the rows of shooters might disappear or be lessened, and the traps might be dismantled? Is that even a possibility? Is that if you win these rounds, do you think that might happen? Do you think it might happen that the trap would be dismantled or no longer used? Is that even a possibility? If so, that's wonderful, obviously.
Yes. One of the goals is just being able to recover bison in their original range. And having that natural dispersal abundance again on the landscape. There shouldn't be this pressure. And the IBMP is like, it's boxed everyone in, including the bison, no room to range. And all the hunters, it's like this limited area, in which bison are tolerated, right? And so there's this tremendous pressure placed on the hunters to kill them in these limited areas in which bison are tolerated. And the whole idea, and then in a trap, you know, within Yellowstone National Park. Love to see it go down, dismantled, removed, and that area, you know, recovered. But we first need to get bison listed. You know, these possibilities and potentials are all there. And it's a 15-round fight, and we have to fight each and every round, you know, trying to get bison recovered in their original range in Yellowstone, which is quite extensive.
So you mentioned before Buffalo Field Campaign, and we have about 5 minutes left. And if you could just tell people, you know, you mentioned that they can volunteer. Can you tell people a little bit more about the history of the organization and about the what you mean by volunteer? I've seen pictures just recently of a friend of mine was volunteering for Buffalo Field Campaign, and so I have seen some pictures, but can you tell me more about what volunteers actually do?
Volunteers are the lifeblood of the campaign. We field patrols every day in the ecosystem following the migrations of the buffalo. You know, our volunteers will be equipped with, you know, obviously cell phones, radios. They'll be on skis, they'll be on snowshoes, patrolling the habitat in which bison migrate. And we keep an eye on things, whether it's the government or anybody else. We monitor the status of the bison, and we document the threats that they're under and the stresses that they face as they migrate to the range. It's very important. We've had several thousand volunteers over the years since we founded it 17 years ago. Rosalie Little Thunder, the late Rosalie Little Thunder, she was one of our co-founders, along with Mike Neese. Rosalie instilled in us and cultural value, you know, the bison have for her people. And she's Lakota, red thigh band, Sakanju, I believe, Oyate. But the volunteer is like this essential being, driving force. We need people on the ground. We're now in the Gardner Basin, the Hebgen Basin. We need enough people on the ground to cover the habitat which bison migrate. It's a very vital service. And volunteers that come to our campaign, I'll make sure you're equipped and trained and, you know, sent out with people that are experienced and show the ropes. And, and we count on those volunteers to take their experience back home, you know, apply it to wherever they may be, the lessons that they took away from being in Yellowstone. It's one of the few training grounds left, you know, for activists in the United States. And you can learn a lot. You can learn a lot about the bison, about the campaign. How to contribute and be part of the effort to protect these bison for future generations. And just go to our website, buffaloscampaign.org, you'll find a volunteer section. We really would appreciate more help on the ground. And if you can't make it, send us some cash. We love cash. Make a contribution. And we appreciate everybody's support.
Well, I do. I know several people who have volunteered who have said it's been an absolutely life-changing experience for them. And but I have one more question before we close, which is that what about somebody who does not have the physical capacity to snow shoe or ski? Do you also need help from people who might not be in, for whom that might be very intimidating?
Absolutely. I mean, if you've got a skill set, how to cook, you can fix cars, you're a handy person, you can fix things. We have cabins, structures that need to be kept up. We have vehicles that need to be kept up and running to help us get out on our patrols. There's food. Food is a key element in our campaign. And there's always a need for people to contribute however they can. There's, if you've got a skill set, it's worth bringing to the campaign. We'll find a way to fit you in.
Well, that sounds really great. And I would like to thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Daryl Geis. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio and the Progressive Radio.